The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 65 for August 14th, 2006. I chat with tabs. Well, a lot of you emailed me and asked for that, so there it is for you. Hi, John. I'm Dave Hamilton. Who are you?
I'm John Braun.
There you go.
Steve talked about that, I think.
I believe he did. Everybody tells me that he did. I still haven't had an opportunity to watch the WWDC stream, but I do intend to.
Neither.
But many of you have emailed me to tell me that my prayers had been answered and that iChat with Tabs is a reality natively in Panther. Of course, it's a whole lot less exciting now that I've been using Chax for months. Chax is great. Gives you iChat with Tabs and many, many other things. But
The listeners are all commenting saying, did you watch that?
Right.
Because like you were talking about stuff and like...
No, the answer is no, I didn't watch it. I read Brian's.
Yeah, we got the reporting, TMO reporting, but
I read Brian's commentary, and he, despite the fact that he was actually even he didn't use iChat until Chax was out because he was addicted to chat to tabs, and it went right over his head too while he was sitting there watching the thing. So there you go. So we are here with a relatively normal show. We've got a little bit of errata to go through at some point, our continuing conversations on TiVo and that sort of thing. And we've got a whole lot of new stuff. So you know what? Let's just dive right in on the new stuff, which actually comes apparently in pairs.
Hi, my name is David Smiley from Somerville, Mass. I have a DVD that is not copy protected because it has content of home videos that I had some business encoded onto DVD for me. And I'm trying to basically rip the content from the DVD onto my computer and have it encoded in something nice like H.264 or MPEG-4. And when I tried to do this using a tool called, I think it's Diva, I could see some deinterlacing going on, and it was really annoying. Now, when I use a DVD player to look at the video, I don't see that at all. As I look very carefully at the different frames, I might see some blurring or whatever, but I definitely do not see interlacing. But when I use the Diva and I use some MPEG-4, I can use QuickTime to export to H.264. I see this interlacing there, and it's frustrating. And I'm just trying to figure out how I can best get that MPEG-2 data off of DVD into H.264 without any interlacing artifacts. Thanks. Bye.
All right. This is, of course, something that you shouldn't be able to do with copy-protected DVDs, but like David said, he's using DVDs that are basically home movies. I think he had a production house make them. But nonetheless, a piece of software called Handbrake should solve all the problems. Have you used Handbrake, John?
No.
Okay.
I had another thought.
All right. Well, Handbrake is a lovely piece of software that will take a DVD, and it actually will rip stuff off of protected or unprotected DVDs. It does not care. And convert it to just about any format that you like. H.264 certainly is one of the options. There's a couple of presets in there for high quality, low quality, and also iPod quality and that sort of thing, so that you can pull things off and get exactly what you need for whatever it is that you're doing. So, David, definitely check out Handbrake. Of course, we'll put a link in the show notes, as we always do. And that should do it for you.
I was wondering if either QuickTime or probably QuickTime Pro to do an export or like Final Cut or something like that would have a conversion, whether it would make sense to use one of those things.
Well, yeah, but he said he was using QuickTime and not getting a good read out of it. But you're right, it would be QuickTime Pro would be the thing that would do it. But I don't know if QuickTime Pro will rip a DVD. I don't think so.
Well, if he's talking about not the DVD itself, because that has a specific structure, but I was just wondering about converting the video if...
I don't think QuickTime will read the VOB files on a DVD. I really don't. It certainly won't play them.
So...
So...
I use other things for doing DVD stuff. But
what do you use?
Well, this is for backing up. What is it? Was it Mac the Ripper or something?
Mac
like that.
The Ripper.
This is for things I own and I want to put on a hard drive. So it's still
Let's get to Wayne's question here. And
yes.
Hey, John and Dave. My name's Wayne. I'm a big fan, and I had a question for you. I love the podcast, and thought it might be up your alley. I'm wanting to back up my DVD collection. I have two kids under the age of 10. They both seem to be in heated competition with me to see if they can destroy my DVDs faster than I can buy them. Their record is to destroy a DVD in less than 2 hours from its purchase as a sideline. I have no nefarious reasons other than avoiding repurchasing repetitive DVDs. Since my collection is in the thousands, I would like to do this quickly. Back in my dark past when I used Windows, it used to be simple to rip DVDs straight into ISO files that you could then play easily and store and move around to some media players. As far as I can see, the only option is to use a program like FastDVDCopy or Mac the Ripper to rip the disk and then use a program like Toast to burn what they call a .toast file. It gets gray as to whether or not I could just change the .toast file into an ISO file, and by merely renaming it, it would behave like an ISO file. I have recently bought the G-Play from G Technologies, and unfortunately, it won't play my MP4 files that I formatted for my video iPod. And I get really good resolution from the video iPod, but with only 60 gig, I wanted the extra 100 gig to be able to put the movies somewhere where the kids could easily get to them. And it's menu-driven and remote and all that good stuff. So there has got to be a better way to rip ISO files onto the Mac. If there is, I'd sure appreciate any help. I'll give a brief pause here and let you...
I think he's going to go into his email address, so we'll simply answer your question here, Wayne. So, like you were saying, John, you use Mac the Ripper, and tell everybody a little bit about what Mac the Ripper does, because both you and Wayne were using it.
Well, I think in this case, really what it was doing, it was just basically pulling and, I think, stripping off. I think it made a nice version that you could play without... I'm not sure if you had to have the disk in or not. I've used a couple of utilities. Some required in there to pull the... because I guess there's some handy little keys on there, and I guess others go a little further.
But yeah, what Mac the Ripper does is it'll rip, right? It'll take the contents of the DVD and transfer them to your hard drive. The one thing that it does is it pulls off the Macrovision protection, which is the thing that typically lets you prevents you from copying a DVD. So it will, if Macrovision protection is there and region encoding too, it'll bypass both of those and put it on your drive. Now, you know, for David's purposes before, he wanted to go to an MPEG file. That Mac the Ripper will not do. Mac the Ripper simply takes an image of the DVD, right, and puts it on your hard drive. Handbrake will not do that, but it will convert it into a movie. So for Wayne's purposes, Mac the Ripper's the first thing, but like Wayne pointed out, it simply leaves you with a folder that looks just like the DVD. Now, you can tell Mac the Ripper to pull the whole DVD or just the main feature so you can skip all the... And that's actually something that we do here with our movies is we... Because I'm in the same boat, two kids under 10. And so we take Mac the Ripper and rip only the movie portion out, leaving all the menus and all that extra junk aside. And then we can burn it to DVD. And that way in the car, there's no press play and, you know, navigate through the menus. You just put the movie in and bam, it's going. So, but that aside, you're left with this folder that, like you said, you can't burn directly to a disc. And the trick is, John and I went through some of this before the show. We actually went through a lot of this. We looked to find that DVDs are burned in what's called the UDF format. And there's two sizes to a DVD, a 4.7 gig or what, single layer. Thank you. And then there's the 8.4, 8.7 dual layer DVDs. And those... older Macs will only burn the single layer DVDs, while newer Macs will burn dual layer. And you can look in your, if you look in your Apple System Profiler, it will tell you. If you look under disk burning, I believe it says DL in write strategies, and that will that'll tell you if it can do it or not. If you don't see DL there, your drive doesn't support it. Now, why does this matter, you ask? Because when you pull a DVD, when you pull data off of a DVD, if it's bigger, most DVDs that you get from the store are the 8-plus gigabyte DVDs. Can't turn around and burn that directly to a 4.7 gig DVD because there's simply not enough room. Now, sometimes the feature is small enough to fit, but most of the time it's not. So you need to use a piece of software like DVD to 1X or Fast DVD Copy, like Wayne mentioned, to convert it down. But even then, you're still stuck with this folder that you can't burn. Most of these software packages actually will turn it into an image that you can then burn with disk copy. But if you have a dual layer drive and you just want to pull it off with Mac the Ripper, there is a piece of software that there's two pieces of software actually that John and I found before. One of them was called DVD Imager, which is free and will do exactly this and pretty much only this, turning the video folder into an image that can be burned to a DVD and then played in a player. And then another piece of software called FFmpeg, which we'll also put in the show notes, that does that and a whole lot more. So those are your options, and I think that's that. Of course, there is the one big thing that Wayne mentioned, and that is Toast. If you want to make this stuff easy, use Toast, because it will convert it down and burn it to a DVD directly. Yes, it's not free, but depending on how often you're doing this, Toast may be the best bet for you. It still won't strip all the data off of a protected DVD, but like I said, Mac the Ripper will do that. Did I get it all, John?
You got it.
Did I really?
Most of it, I think.
All right, good. And the new version of Toast 7 will do dual layer. I've experimented with that in the house, and it's worked fine. One thing I'll say about dual layer, which is true of any other type of burnable media, you get what you pay for. Do we need to do it this way? You get what you pay for. Because we bought some media that was just pure crap. It was cheap, you know, buck a disc or something, but or less than a buck a disc. But
and I think not all, and as far as I know, all optical media will deteriorate
over time. Yeah,
yeah.
I think so. Do we know what the half life is of a CDR?
CDRs, I don't know. I think tens of years. So I don't
okay.
know.
Okay, decades.
20, 30, decades, okay. As far as I know. CDRWs, I think, are less because there's usually less stability.
Yeah.
But yeah, who would have thought? So put on a hard drive or make a backup or speaking of backups or whatever we're speaking of next.
We'll go through some errata. Last week we talked about a couple of things. The first was that I mentioned SuperClock, which I said was from OS 9. Really, it was from OS 6, or System 6, as it was called in those days, and then was included by Apple into OS 7. So that was the errata on that. And then there was another thing about batch get info. This gets very interesting.
Oh, yes. So
you want to take it, John?
Our listeners. I mean, I could take it. It's basically, so we were... So the statement both Dave and I made, which we thought was correct, was that, you know, when you highlight something in the Finder and you say get info, if you highlight 1,000 things, you will get 1,000 windows. And both Dave and I, unless we're starting to both have a, you know, mutual hallucination, both remember this happening in a prior version.
It wouldn't be the first time, John.
And I guess because it so scarred us, we both... never did it again.
That's right.
Nor had a reason to, and then people started writing into both of us. Thank you so much for writing us. You know, you can't... writing is one option, but you can call us, too.
Right, yeah, but they didn't call us. 206-666-GEEK! It would be the way to do it. But so we've been going back and forth with Colin here, because Colin discovered that there seems to be this 10-item barrier. So if you select 10 or less items... in Tiger, you get a separate window for each one. 11 or more, and it's a single window used for all. Of course, you can switch this behavior by holding down the Option key either way. Toggles it back and forth. However, in Panther, it seems to be 2 or more items gets you the all-in-one window.
Really?
Yes. Yeah,
you know, I prefer the other, though what's kind of aggravating, and I haven't tried all the key combos yet, because, yeah, other people told us, hold down Apple, Command.
Command, yeah, we'll call it Command.
And that will also invoke a batch.
No,
viewer.
Option, so, Option, because you've already got
option.
Apple down, yeah. Yeah.
Sorry, so Option, yeah, so Option, Command, I will do, so, and it says bring up, I think, Inspector.
Window, show Inspector is what
show
it says.
Show Inspector.
Yep.
which is that, I guess what they call that summary window, which is like, okay. You want to call it inspector? Sure.
Right.
But I couldn't find a way. Say you picked 20 items and then wanted to view individual windows.
I think.
I don't know if you can. I don't know if you can second guess them or if you can like unoption them.
I think the option key would do exactly that. And I will. I'll test it here for you, John.
Okay. I was fiddling around with it later today, and as far as I can tell, from I talked to a few.
No,
of our,
it won't. Option key will not toggle that behavior.
Yeah. So I was messing with that. So if it's not what you want, then that's kind of annoying. But the nice thing I think is that. It sounds like pretty reasonable assumption that if you're highlighting 10 things, you don't want to have 10 windows. But
right.
Who knows? But they tuned it. Two was probably a bit too small. Like Panther. So that gives a... And I checked with some of our... we still have some students at work, and they're all Windows jockeys. And they're not aware of a way to change the behavior at all in Windows. If you highlight multiple things, you get a summary window always. So.
Huh.
But there could be a way to get around that. I was starting to look through, and I think we're doing an upcoming show on this, on all these mysterious key combinations that do sometimes useful things. Though it is kind of fun on the Mac because...
I was going to let Dusty talk, but go ahead.
Yeah, we'll let Dusty... No, I was just saying it's kind of fun on the Mac because usually most of the apps, if you hold down a modifier key and there's a menu up, it'll show you in real time what's going to happen. And I noticed that also... with the contextual menu, when I was fiddling around trying to find maybe a hidden or undocumented way of doing this. So that's good behavior that it kind of makes it. The keyboard control, I think, is still not quite up to par, though it's better. We talked about that, but
yeah.
Dusty, yeah, let Dusty speak.
Hi, Dave and John. This is Dusty from York, Pennsylvania. I have a bunch of questions for you guys. I love the show, though. It's awesome. Wanted to let you know what kind of system I'm running. I have a Power Mac G5 2.7 with 2.5 gigs of RAM and the stock 250 gig hard drive that came with it. What I'd like to know is if you could explain how the inside actually works. I mean, the operating system came as like 4 gigs. I have 2.5 gigs. Does it all get dumped into there? What goes into the L2 cache on the chip? And that kind of stuff. The reason why I'm asking this is because I'm thinking of buying another hard drive or adding more RAM because I'm doing a lot of stuff with iMovie and iDVD. And since I heard you say that you upgraded your MacBook Pro from the 54 to the 72 because of the speed bump, I was thinking of upgrading my hard drive to a 10,000 spin hard drive. And would I see any speed increase with my operating system? So anything that you could do would be a great help. My email.
Oh, we'll stop it right there because, wow, that's a lot of questions. Okay, so let's start with his first question, which was he knows that Tiger is about 4 gigs, the OS is about 4 gigs, and does that load into his 2.5 gigs of RAM? How does that work? So that we'll talk about that first. You want to take it, John, or should I just keep on rolling here?
No, when you're saying that, you're saying what, the size of the system folder?
Well, the Tiger DVD, right? I think he just assumed. So Tiger is, let's say for the sake of argument, Tiger's 4 gigs, right? Maybe it's a little bigger, maybe it's a little smaller.
Okay.
He wants to know how that fits into his 2.5 gigs of RAM, which basically shows a need to understand the fundamentals here. What happens is the OS is a whole lot of different components. Many of them you'll never use. Most of them you won't use most of the time. And there's only a very small part that's always used, the kernel and the various extensions for networking and, of course, drawing windows and stuff. It's a lot. But as compared to the grand sum total, it's not everything. So when the
system... The system folder is 1.8 gigs
on your machine. Okay.
But go on, please.
So the OS loads what it needs and all the services that it needs, and then leaves the rest of your RAM available for other apps. And I know we've talked about it before, but menu meters is a great tool and a great way to really see what's going on with your system. But you can also do it with the activity monitor. And if you go to system memory, you'll see a couple of different things. And we won't go too deep here, because we've done it in the past, but you've got wired, active, inactive, and then free. shown in the activity monitor. And really free and inactive are, and this is, again, a generalization, but if you add together free and inactive, that will show how much of your RAM is available to be used by new things. Inactive means that something was loaded into it at one point and it simply hasn't been flushed out because it didn't need to be. If you see free RAM getting real low, below like 50 megs, then it means that you're probably hitting a wall. But again, maybe not. Really looking at the size of your swap files is the way to do that. And menu meters is by far and away the easiest way to check that. So we won't go into all the other ways of doing it. But no, the whole OS does not load into RAM all at once. As it needs things, it loads them into RAM. And then if it doesn't need it anymore, it simply marks it as, I don't need this anymore. And that moves it into inactive RAM, rather. It moves from active to inactive. Once it's in inactive, it stays there until something needs that space. If it doesn't need the space, it leaves it. It's a cache, if you will. And then if that same thing needs to be used again, well, it doesn't need to be loaded from the disk. It's just sitting there, idle, ready to go. Did I get that close to right, John? You see any flaws in my logic there?
Okay. And I could mention another thing. Activity Monitor tells you a few things, including if you just want to get a general feel for how much memory everybody wants.
Yeah.
You'll see the process list if you do the, that particular window. Which one is it here? Yes, the
Activity Monitor window. Yeah.
Activity Monitor window, and so you see real memory, virtual memory, and that gives you a feel for how much it needs.
But, real memory. Real memory is showing you how much actual physical RAM a piece of software is using, and that's just
on your chips.
On your chips, exactly. Thank you, John. Yes.
Yeah. So, and I think the question was regarding RAM.
Yeah. It was. He wanted to know if his OS loaded all into RAM, and it doesn't. So
no,
not all of it. I mean, some of it does, but not the whole thing at once. Okay. So his second question was level 2 cache. What loads into level 2 cache? What programs load there? You want to take this one, John? I know you've done some of this stuff.
Level 2 cache. That's a good one.
All right. Level 2 cache is on his processors, right? I mean, that's...
I mean, being on the processor, I wouldn't think it's very data specific. So anything that, runs fairly on a fairly regular basis is going to be sitting there. As far as the algorithms, do you know? I mean...
I believe the...
Is bigger is better. And things that the processor determines, are run often. Go in there.
I think the way I understand the level 2 cache, and please, if we get this wrong, let us know, but believe what it does is it takes, into the processor comes a set of instructions, right? Instructions, and then the processor crunches the instructions and generates a result. Everything, the instructions and the result, is then stored in level 2 cache. So if you've got the same set of instructions being called many, many times over, the processor doesn't have to do anything because it can simply tap, it says, look, I already know the answer to that. I don't need to figure it out. And it just hands it off without having to run through the processor. Can make things very, very efficient, especially with stuff that's happening repetitively. So that's what the level 2 cache is. It doesn't load, it certainly doesn't load, mail or BBEdit or anything like that into it. It's just for instructions.
I have more, unless you have
go.
More.
Go.
Okay. I was just poking around here online. So this is one where, we'll help you do the research. But level two is separate from the processor. Level 1 is the cache on the processor. From what I can see, the level 2 is usually bigger and slower, but it's nice to have it. So rather than getting things from memory, I guess level 1 cache is the first place and the fastest
on the chip, right?
On the PowerPC or other chip. Level 2 is outside, and that's better. And then if it's not there, so I would say, the bigger any one of them is, not just for a processor but for a hard drive as well, which I think was another question.
That was the next question, was should he add more RAM to his machine, or should he add a bigger hard drive?
Now,
yes.
This I know. I mean, if you look at the relative speed of the two mediums, you definitely would want to be pulling things from RAM versus a hard drive.
Right.
But they're catching up.
Yeah.
So if I had to get one or the other, I would get more RAM.
For what he's doing, unless he's actually run out of hard drive space. And if you've run out of hard drive space, then, well, you need more space. But if you're looking to speed up the machine, John, you couldn't have hit the nail on the head any better. Get more RAM. The more RAM you have, the less it has to use the hard drive. So,
I still remember now, it's coming back to me, it comes back to us. But I think you did this too, is that you could get for some of the, power computing clones, you could actually buy a larger level 2 cache if you wanted to. They offer that option. And I guess various vendors, not so much Apple, I don't think, will let you fiddle and tweak your machine and add more level 2. But I distinctly remember one of those machines, I actually bought the level 2 cache speed up because it just made me the envy of all my friends. It sped it up a little bit. Hello?
All right, so definitely RAM is better than hard drive at speeding up the system for what he's doing there, no question. Now, if you want to get it faster, if you want to get a hard drive, he mentioned that there's, 7,200 RPM and 10,000 RPM drives. Of course, they're faster than 5,400 and 4,800 and so on down the line.
You have that metric.
That's right. And the speed of the drive, it's the speed at which the drive spins. So we're talking about 10,000 RPMs or 7,200
right.
or whatever.
And generally faster is better, I would say.
I would agree. Yeah. Again, the question always is, yes, faster is better, but are you going to notice it? And depending on how much data you're reading and writing to that drive all the time, if your computer's a server, like the web server that runs MacObserver.com, that's got a 10,000 RPM drive in it. It's got a couple of them, actually. And it makes a huge difference because there's constantly things being written, read, and, all that good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
On your machine, is 72 to 10 going to make a huge difference? Probably not. But again, if you're moving big files around, it can. It certainly can.
Yeah.
Going with a big, fast SATA drive, not so bad.
But all in all, SATA or I don't know. I still say serial ATA. I don't know if I'm cool enough to say SATA, but you got that. You have another thing which I usually see come up, but it's the access speed, which is the speed at which the head can go from one track to the other. And I think that's in the singles of milliseconds now. I don't think that's gotten smaller than that, right? Are you with me?
I don't think so. I don't think it's gotten smaller.
I recall 8 or 5 is a good figure. And then the cache on the drive, too. And it's kind of like the cache we were talking about before, level 2 cache. But, most drives, from what I've seen, only have one cache. And again, the bigger, the better. I've seen these weird combos, like especially the Maxsters, for example, they would have slow speeds and, you would get different drives that hit different price points. Like some would be very large, but they would have slow cache and low RPMs and the other way around. So you got to look at the combo of that, and you'll pay for it if you want all of them to be the higher end features.
Yeah.
Or, do a RAID deal if you want the speed.
Yeah, that's right. And you can go back
striping,
to our,
I guess, right?
Our RAID show to talk about that. That's right. Yeah. Absolutely.
Talked about that. So, if you can afford both, get more RAM and another hard drive. Stimulate the economy.
That's right. That's right. Head us into the fourth quarter with some fervor. All right. We'll visit our TiVo/Vonage/VOIP conversation because Tim had an excellent perspective on this.
Hey, guys. Tim here from Cincinnati, Ohio. I'm sure you're going to get lots of calls about this one, but in your last show, number 64, you guys responded to somebody having TiVo issues over their Vonage voiceover IP telephone. Well, I have this set up, except I don't have Vonage. I have AT&T Call Vantage, but the solution works great. In fact, I don't even know what the voice quality is like because I never use my Call Vantage line for voice communications. I only use it for 3 devices, all of which have modems in them. I've got a fax machine, which works great. I've got a little remote access key, because I'm a real estate agent, that lets me get into people's houses. Well, that thing updates daily over my voice over IP line and the TiVo. Everything seems to work. As far as helping out your caller from the last show, a couple of things I would look at. The first thing I would check is if the guy has a DSL connection, he might have a DSL filter installed on the entire house at the demarcation point, which is where the phone line comes into the house and gets distributed off to all the jacks. That might cause a problem if he's using his existing phone infrastructure, the phone line in his house, plugged into the back of his Vonage box. The next thing I would try, if that's not it, I would try switching the phone number on my TiVo. The TiVo should have a list of numbers built into it that you can, and kind of like AOL, you know, where you pick the best line. It doesn't always get it, so that might be a problem. And the third thing I would try is call Vantage, because it seems to work really well for me. Anyway, love the show, and thanks a lot, guys.
Thanks, Tim. Yeah, that I believe it, with other folks that I know that have been through all this, the TiVo answer, it simply, if it doesn't work, it doesn't work, or the Vonage answer, rather. So call Vantage, then who knows? They might, I guess they assemble their packets differently than the Vonage and various other VOIP folks. So who knows? I thought it would all be done the same way using SIP, but I guess not.
Oh, no. Guess not.
Oh, no. And Tim, of course, sent that in to, well, actually, he just emailed this voice comment in, but you can do it much easier, much more easily than Tim. 206-666-GEEK is the way to get your stuff in. Do we have time for more? We do have time for more. You know, I've had this thing on here from Jeremy for a while, and I wanted to talk through it. What's that?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, we've had this on the agenda for about a month. Yeah. Jeremy writes, I have this weird thing happening to my trash folder where every time I reboot or turn on my computer and I know the trash folder is empty, there will be a recovered files folder inside. Now I can empty it in both the normal and secure zero the space way, but it will always have this folder in it. I know it's just a PNG file, which is a green bar of some sort. Is there a way I can track which program or whatever is doing it and stop it as it's getting annoying? Cheers, Jeremy. Well, the gist is this. Any program that uses the temporary items folder, now that can either be at the root of your hard drive / temporary items or in your user folder. I believe it's in, I think it's just in temp in your user folder. I believe so, right, John? Did I get that right? No, it's just temporary items. There it is. So you've got it, one in your user folder and one in your main folder there, the root of the drive rather. If there's something in there, and in your user folder, you're going to need to go one level deeper into a folder called 501, and that's or whatever 500 number you see. It depends on what your user ID is, but for the main machine on the computer, it'll usually be 501. But if you're having this problem, I wouldn't go deleting things in there summarily, but if you're having this problem where something's simply not leaving, anything that's in these temporary items folders on reboot will be put into this recovered files folder in the trash. This is because these are, as you might guess, places for programs to store temporary items. And if something's left there, it usually indicates that a program didn't clean its mess up. So it moves it out there and you're good to go. There can be a permissions thing where it may not be able to move the file, and as such, you can have one that's just stuck in a loop. So heading in there and yanking it out would be the that would be the way to do it. So
bad program.
Well, or yeah, it could have been it could definitely be a bad program, but it could also be just you know, if your machine restarted or whatever, you know, if it froze and you had to reboot it without properly quitting the app. If you force quit the app, it may or may not, you know, clean that stuff up either. I wouldn't expect that it would.
Yeah, I'm looking at another place too, / TMP. I don't know if you mentioned that. Mm-hmm. That's just another. And actually, I see in here a 501 directory with a very recent date and then something cs_cache_lock_501.
Hmm. Yeah.
So what's that all about? I'll have to look into that.
You'll have to check it
what
out.
What else? John. Oh, I got a chuckle of an email here.
What email did you get, John?
The one from David Hassel.
There you go.
David Hassel saw the story on the BBC News website. The message he sent along was, has John been on a little vacation recently? And the headline for the article is, phone vigilante slashes car tires. More than 20 Hampshire motorists have had their car tires slashed by a mystery mobile phone vigilante, and its tires, T-Y-R-E-S, because it's from across the pond. And I read about this story because I keep up with this stuff with a fervor. No, but apparently, yeah, a guy would leave notes on people's windows and say, I saw you using your phone, and then he would slash their tires. Now, I certainly don't support that sort of thing.
Wow.
I just give people nasty looks, or maybe, you know, if they're driving the way that they're driving, I am willing to call 911, you know, as their vehicle turns into, you know, a smoldering heap of burning wreckage because of their driving habits.
Wow. But come on, John, tell us how you seem to be pulling some punches here. I mean,
I'm holding back.
Yeah, I don't know that I like this. We gotta do this, you know. You gotta commit when you do this show. So
what else we got?
We got this.
Hi guys, John from Wisconsin. Got a really kind of a peculiar situation.
Oh,
John,
tell me about it.
In a nutshell, trying to do my software updates for OS 10, which is fine, no big deal. However, in May, QuickTime 7.12, whenever I would try to do an update on my iBook G4, I would get the total size was 51.4 megs. And I would get all the way up to 51.3 megs, and I would get a network timeout error, -1000. You know, and I tried this with the airport or connected hardwired directly to the router. However, and that is at home now at work, for the solution, I just took the QuickTime app, which updated with no problem at all, copied over to some drive, brought it home, and did the upgrade, you know, copied over and said yes to replace with a newer item, so on and so forth. Then I did the software update again from Mac, and the update went fine. You know, it didn't error out or nothing like that. The installation, you know, went fine. But any other software update, you know, using my iBook G4 went fine. You know, if it would be iTunes or just your OS 10, you know, software updates went fine, except for QuickTime.
All right, I have an idea. You have an idea, John?
That's whack, man.
It is whack, but...
I have an idea.
Go.
Running out of space, maybe. But I'm just thinking, is that while it was... I don't know. I'm thinking it was not able to do something with a file that it was trying to replace. So whether it was corrupted or locked or...
Yep.
Or I don't know, anything else you're thinking of?
Well, you hit it on the head. That's right. It's trying to do something with a file it can't. So
because I notice at the end of the software update, it usually has these messages that kind of hint at, you know, cleaning. You know what I'm talking about? A lot of times it runs
through the optimization step a lot with the software update.
Yes.
But the first thing I would try if he's having this issue is repair permissions. Now, of course, by copying something on top of it. He blew away whatever was there, and
which may have fixed the problem. It did.
It fixed that particular problem. That's right. So, but you know, repairing permission. This is one of those things where having everything with the right permissions matters. You know, if a file's locked, and locked, it means you don't have right access to it. So, repairing the permissions may fix that. But that's one step. Deleting it. Actually, deleting it wouldn't work because it wouldn't know where to put the replacement. So, you know, copying one from another machine—that's a very resourceful solution there. Sort of blows away the problem. So we don't know what the problem was. But one of my favorite things to say when troubleshooting is, you know, when someone asks why, my favorite answer is, well, if this is the first time it happened, let's just fix it. Let's not worry about why. You know, if it happens again and again, all right, now we'll ask why. But often why is a very difficult question to answer, a very time-consuming question to answer. And if it's a one-shot deal, well, just take it and run with it.
Because sometimes you just don't know.
That's right, yeah.
We can pretend.
That's right.
Yeah, like we do.
Like we do every week here.
We got the dartboard, and you know, every now and then we usually get the right. Believe it or not, we have this big dartboard up with all the answers that we've ever given.
I don't know where you're going with this, man. You're on your own. I'm gonna drive and talk on the phone while you're driving down
Thanks.
That path. Yeah, you bet. Yeah. Hey, so go to Portable Media Expo. John and I will certainly be there. Did you book your flights yet, man?
I picked out the one I want that I think is the best times and the best price.
Well, giddy up. Go ahead and book it. Let's go.
Yeah. I think, you know, because I'm not into the 6 a.m. flights, but I found one that...
Yeah, I got the same
thing. It's kind of tight.
Leaving Boston, it's the same thing.
Well, I have one in one terminal. It's like warning, short trip. It's like 30 minutes between planes, which does sound kind of...
That's tight.
Or no, 40 minutes.
Oh, the
they say short.
You can do
40,
that.
40, as long as it's not a huge terminal like some...
Which terminal is it?
Is it St. Louis? It's St. Louis, I think.
Oh, that's not so bad. That's not so bad. That's an easy one. Yeah.
Or they got a tram or something. I don't know.
Cool.
Yeah, things sound like they got back to normal.
That's Portable Media Expo in September, of course, at the end of September, last weekend.
End of September.
And Ricky will be there, too.
We're going to leave in October.
That's right. We'll be coming home in October. I don't know if we'll do a show there or not, because frankly, the way airport security is, I don't know if I'm going to bring all the stuff.
Oh, man.
But we'll see.
No, they're all metal. They haven't prohibited metals yet.
They haven't, huh? Okay, that's good.
Yeah, and most of your gear is metal, so.
I would say there's a good healthy dose of metal in most of this stuff. So, of course, CashFly Hosting, as you know, is where you download this
from.
Oh, yeah. And if you want to sponsor the show, contact the Backbeat Media Podcast Network. That's the way to do it. I don't think we have anything else, so we're out of here for this week. But thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for staying subscribed. And we'll see you next week.
And your feedback. And we love your feedback. It helps improve us, and it helps improve
you.
You.
What? What? MacGeekGab at MacObserver.com, 206-666-GEEK. Skype to MacGeekGab. Thanks.
Who let the dogs out?
Go to iTunes and write some comments. But while you're there, make very, very certain that you don't get caught.
Made on the back.
The hell was that?